Normally, I would say as we join Century Cable and Charter Cable, get on the phone, let us know you're there. I don't want anybody on the phone tonight. Until I say get on the telephone, don't make any calls. I started a subject last night as I returned to the Great Pyramid of Egypt. It never was a tomb, never was intended to be a tomb. The so-called cartouche of Khufu was a forgery put there by Colonel Voss. There are no hieroglyphics in the Great Pyramid. It wasn't built by Khufu. It was there when Khufu became Pharaoh. The word means light, covered with white limestone. It shined like a jewel, so bright its reflections from the sun could be seen as far away as Palestine. It meant light. Khufu took the name of the pyramid, not the other way around. Wasn't built, as the Egyptologists say, around 2500 BC. It was there when those old kingdoms emerged. Then we turn to the Sphinx. West is convincingly proven, NBC carried a special, that the Sphinx has erosion from water, not wind and sand. Oh yeah, wind and sand in the near history. But the majority of the erosion on the Sphinx is from water. That pushes the timeline back to more than 10,000 BC. The Bible clearly speaks of ancient times, ancient peoples, smarter than we are, closer to God, the source of all knowledge, than we are, who accomplish things that we couldn't accomplish. Now, this nonsense that Adam was created in 4004 BC is from a medieval monk trying to interpret genealogy tables with the mentality of those that thought the earth was flat and that the sun went around the earth. Between Genesis 1:1 and 1:2, there is a vast gulf of time. In the beginning, God created. Or as the Hebrew would have it, the beginning of God's creation. Jeremiah saw a past tense vision, said it was created not a waste. Then the second verse in the King James says the earth was without form and void. Now, just as legitimate, the earth became a waste and a desolation. And that's the way it's translated in Jeremiah's prophecy. When a great cataclysm strikes the earth, mountains move at a time before there was any man. Yet there were Ayar, which are meeting places of intelligent beings, translated cities in the King James. And some great cataclysm struck the earth, and it became a waste and a desolation. The Bible speaks of cyclical advances and catastrophes and startovers. The application of evolution to social history stretches it a bit, because it assumes that everything has always happened the same way, and man has progressed from the Stone Age through the Bronze Age, through Iron, Bronze, right on up ever progressing upward. Not so. Nobody in the world today could build the pyramid as it was built in Egypt with the magnificent qualities that we talked about last night. The Sphinx was built before a time of water erosion when it's 60 feet to the height of the shoulders of the Sphinx. There was somebody back there, real smart. The Bible has people that were living 700, 800, 900 years. Do you have any idea how smart you would be if you could live that long? I've learned more the last 5 years than I did all the other years of my life. Knowledge compounds. I did a PhD at Stanford. Didn't learn as much in the 9.5 years pursuing all the degrees that led me to the PhD as I have the last 5 years. God, I'd be smart if I could live to be 700. Pyramid was not built by some Stone Age guy, as I said the other night, whose wife had a headache, or PMS, and he went out running out of the cave, swinging his stone axe, knocking rocks around, and just happened to align the pyramid to true north and make it a perfect replica of the northern half of the globe and find the spot on the globe where it would crosshair the greatest landmass, the center of the landmasses of the earth. If you run a line down north and south and east and west through its position, it ought to be mean time, not Greenwich. Containing in its mathematical formulas that wonderful measuring unit, the pyramid inch, which is 1/500,000,000th of the distance from the north to the south pole, so perfectly aligned to true north that scientists have been amazed that a building so massive could be perfectly aligned in that way. Containing in its dimensions the calendar that we use, the earth around the sun, and the 365 1/4, loosely speaking, days of the year, the sidereal calendar, which is when the earth returns to a fixed position in relation to a fixed star, and the anomalistic year, which takes into account the elliptical orbit, and perihelion, when the earth is closest to the sun in its elliptical orbit and returns to that point. They knew all of this. They encompassed pi, the golden mean. In a building so large you could put our capital, Notre Dame, and Westminster Abbey inside of it and still have space. 70-ton blocks hewed in 5x7 joints, 35 square feet, with a deviation of these limestone blocks, 70 tons in weight, joined together in joints, 35 feet square, with a deviation, a mean deviation of 1/50 of an inch. Somebody back there was smart. Now, from the pyramid, I'm going to Fingerprints of the Gods, Graham Hancock. I'll repeat something I did several weeks ago. This is a response to a letter written by Charles H. Hapgood, 8th Reconnaissance Technical Squadron, SAC, United States Air Force, Westover Air Force Base, Massachusetts, July 6, 1960. The subject, Admiral Peary Reese World Map. From Harold Z. Olmeyer, Lieutenant Colonel, U.S. Air Force Commander, Westover Air Force Base, to Professor Charles H. Hapgood, King College, Keene, New Hampshire. Dear Professor Hapgood, your request for evaluation of certain unusual features of the Peary Reese World Map of 1513 by this organization has been reviewed. Admiral Peary Reese produced this map from sources that must have matriculated from Alexandria to Constantinople, still available to him when this admiral produced the map. Eighth Reconnaissance Technical Squadron, United States Air Force, Lieutenant Colonel Harold Z. Olmeyer responds to a request to evaluate certain features. And I read, your request for evaluation of certain unusual features of the Peary Reese world map of 1513 by this organization has been reviewed. The claim that the lower part of the map portrays the Princess Martha coast of Queen Maud Land, Antarctica, and the Palmer Peninsula is reasonable. We find this is the most logical and in all probability the correct interpretation of the map. The geographical detail shown in the lower part of the map agrees very remarkably with the results of the seismic profile made across the top of the ice cap by the Swedish-British Antarctica expedition of 1949. This indicates the coastline had been mapped before it was covered by the ice cap. The ice cap in this region is now about a mile thick. We have no idea how the data on this map can be reconciled with the supposed state of geographical knowledge in 1513. Now, the Peary Reese map, which is a genuine document, not a hoax of any kind, was made at Constantinople in A.D. 1513. It focuses on the western coast of Africa, the eastern coast of South America, and the northern coast of Antarctica, which now is under a mile deep ice cap. Peary Reese could not have acquired his information on Antarctica from contemporary explorers because Antarctica remained undiscovered until 1818, more than 300 years after he drew the map. The ice-free coast of Queen Maud Land, shown in the map, is a colossal puzzle because the geological evidence confirms that the latest date it could have been surveyed and charted in an ice-free condition is 4000 BC, 6000 years ago. It is not possible to pinpoint the earliest date that such a task could have been accomplished, but it seems that the Queen Maud Land littoral may have remained in a stable, unglaciated condition for at least 9,000 years before the spreading ice cap swallowed it entirely. There is no civilization known to history that had the capacity or need to survey that Antarctica coastline in the relevant period between 13,000 BC and 4,000 BC. In other words, the true enigma of this 1513 map is not so much its inclusion of a continent not discovered until 1818, but its portrayal of part of the coastline of that continent under ice-free conditions, which came to an end 6,000 years ago and have not since recurred. He drew the map from sources . This won't show you the detail, but this is the map on the right side where my finger is here. The Peary Reese map was drawn from sources available to him that show Antarctica's coastline free of ice . And the scientific expedition referred to by the U.S. commander with seismic detail and modern scientific instruments to penetrate the ice and map the coastline, show the rivers and the mountains, in exactly the places that the Piri Reis map shows them. The Piri Reis map, ice-free, the scientific survey mapping the contour underneath the ice, exactly as the Piri Reis map showed it. In his day, Piri Reis was a well-known figure. His historical identity is firmly established. An admiral in the navy of the Ottoman Turks, he was involved, often on the winning side, in numerous sea battles around the mid-16th century. He was, in addition, considered an expert on the lands of the Mediterranean, was the author of a famous sailing book, which provided a comprehensive description of the coast, harbors, currents, shallows, landing places, bays, and straits of the Aegean and Mediterranean seas. Despite this illustrious career, he fell foul of his masters and was beheaded in A.D. 1554 or 1555. The source maps Piri Reis used to draw up his 1513 map were in all probability lodged originally in the Imperial Library at Constantinople, to which the admiral is known to have enjoyed privileged access. Those sources, which may have been transferred or copied from even more ancient centers of learning, no longer exist or at any rate have not been found. It was, however, in the library of the old imperial palace at Constantinople that the Piri Reis map was discovered, painted on a gazelle skin, and rolled up on a dusty shelf as recently as 1929. As the baffled Olmeyer admitted in his letter to Hapgood in 1960, the Piri Reis map depicts the subglacial topography, the true profile of Queen Maud Land, Antarctica, beneath the ice. This profile remained completely hidden from view from 4000 BC until it was revealed again as a result of the comprehensive seismic survey of Queen Maud Land carried out during 1949 by a joint British-Swedish scientific reconnaissance team. If Piri Reis had been the only cartographer with access to such anomalous information, now I started on the pyramid last night teaching. From all these different sources, the idea of the earliest intelligent man, Adam, for want of a better term, appearing on the scene in 4004 B.C., based upon a medieval monk's genealogical analysis, when the genealogy tables are as unreliable as two and three generations each time. Sons or grandsons, great-grandsons, nephews, sons, the words used loosely. No way possible you could get the age of mankind descended from Adam through genealogy tables. Don't blame the Bible for what a medieval monk stuck his head in some orifice and came up with. The Bible, as I've said, has a vast gulf of time between Genesis 1:1 and 1:2. Other passages equally significant that I'll get to. And now I'm pushing from many sources the evidence of ancient civilizations dating back before what we know to be the Ice Age covering Antarctica. If Piri Reis had been the only cartographer with access to such anomalous information, we might not place such a great weight, Hapgood says, but I would. But anyway, I'll go on with him as the one, at the most, one might say, perhaps it is significant, but then again, perhaps it's just a coincidence. Come on, Hapgood, you're being too nice. It ain't no coincidence somebody maps the contours verified by seismic investigation in 1949 in an area in 1513 that hadn't been discovered until 1818 and has the topography exactly as the 1949 survey shows it beneath a mile of ice. Man, that's playing it down too much. He didn't have to say that to get me to listen to the other cartographers. However, the Turkish admiral was by no means alone in the possession of seemingly impossible and inexplicable geographical knowledge. You know, academics really need to learn. I may be the only academic in the world that when I know something's right will look at the idiots and say, up yours. I mean, I get so tired of academicians trying to sound humble. Perhaps it is significant, but then again, perhaps it's just a coincidence. Huh? Excuse me? However, the Turkish admiral was by no means alone. Why not just say, not only this, but these others? I ain't going to listen to that apology for moving to the next phase. To hell with the academicians. If they keep their head up their orifices, that's their problem. In the Christmas recess, there are other maps, is what he's trying to say. Not just Pee-wee. Not just Pee-wee Reese. Are you awake?
Yes, sir.
In the Christmas recess of 1959-60, Charles Hapgood was looking for Antarctica in the reference room of the Library of Congress, Washington, D.C. For several consecutive weeks, he worked there, lost in the search, surrounded by literally hundreds of medieval maps and charts. I found, he reported, many fascinating things I had not expected to find, and a number of charts showing the southern continent. Then one day I turned a page and sat transfixed as my eyes fell upon the southern hemisphere of a world map drawn by Orontius Phanaeus in 1531. I had the instant conviction that I had found here a truly authentic map of the real Antarctica. Still 300 years, minus maybe 11, or a few, before Antarctica was discovered. The general shape of the continent was startlingly like the outline of the continent on our modern maps. The position of the South Pole, nearly in the center of the continent, seemed about right. Now, all these people running around, particularly the fundamentalists, carrying on their stupid fight with evolution. I mean, evolution's a theory to explain a sequential laying down of strata and a sequential progress from the simple to the complicated in the development of life forms. It's just a theory. You can't prove it, but it's about the best theory to come along. You don't have to choose between God and evolution. If I were God, I'd probably do it the same way. Time means nothing to him. He's before and he's after. I believe that there is built into the universe a positive element. Faith works, whether you have faith in God or not. But then they apply evolution, over-apply it. That everything has to proceed at the same rate all the time. And the fundamentalists are out there parking their brains and saying God gave the King James to Adam and Eve as his first act in the garden. I'm exaggerating a bit, but you don't have to choose between science and the Bible. At no place does the Bible suggest the short time span that we've been taught in fundamentalist circles to believe. I've already said there's a vast gulf of time between Genesis 1:1 and 1:2. Both Ezekiel and Isaiah saw Satan in Eden before he fell. And you encounter him after Genesis 1:2 in a fallen state. I've already said Jeremiah saw the earth before there was Adam. And yet there were cities. King James says, Ayar, meeting places of intelligent beings. We don't know how long and how many times things happened on the earth before God broods over it. Then comes the cataclysm of the flood. You haven't got an accurate date on the flood. You can't use genealogies for that. We don't know when the flood occurred. We just know there's a worldwide accordance that this earth has been smitten by a terrible flood whether completely covering every part of it or not, enough of it that every culture has memory traces of it. You'll know the date of the flood. Quit reducing God down from a size much larger than our minds have been able to comprehend into one little peanut-sized God that fits your view of Him. And how many people out there have ever studied ancient maps? Yet their knee-jerk reaction is, oh no, this couldn't be. Well, you listen. The general shape of the continent was startlingly like the outline of the continent on our modern maps. The position of the South Pole, nearly in the center of the continent, seemed about right. The mountain ranges that skirted the coasts suggested the numerous ranges that have been discovered in Antarctica in recent years. It was obvious, too, that this was no slapdash creation of somebody's imagination. The mountain ranges were individualized, some definitely coastal and some not. From most of them, rivers were shown flowing into the sea, following in every case what looked like very natural and very convincing drainage patterns. This suggested, of course, that the coast may have been ice-free when the original map was drawn. The deep interior, however, was free entirely of rivers and mountains, suggesting that the ice might have been present there in this map. Closer investigation of the Rhontius-Phineas map by Hapgood and by Dr. Richard Strachan of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology confirmed the following. It had been copied and compiled from several earlier source maps, drawn up according to a number of different projections. It did indeed show non-glacial conditions in coastal regions of Antarctica, notably Queen Maud Land, Enderby Land, Wilkes Land, Victoria Land, the east coast of the Ross Sea, and Marie Byrd Land. As in the case of the Peary Reese map, the general profile of the terrain and the visible physical features matched closely seismic survey maps of the subglacial land surfaces of Antarctica. Now, you're not going to be able to see this, but in this book, the map we're talking about is reproduced, and you can study it yourself. I'm reading from Fingerprints of the Gods, Graham Hancock. If you want me to continue, you better get on the telephone.
This is the end of Side 1.